It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all of our podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope you will rate, review, and subscribe to this one and share it with your friends if you like what you hear. Coming up, we have an interview with Mark Esper. He is the former Secretary of Defense and the author of the new book, A Sacred Oath, Memoirs of a Secretary of Defense During Extraordinary Times. He's done a number of interviews that touch on his relationship with President Trump and the back and forth between them. Our interview focused more on the military itself, namely critiques that during his tenure, the Navy continued to fall behind and that the force really drifted into an increased nature of wokeness at a time when we really need America's military to function well. In addition, we have an interview with Hung Cao. He is the new nominee from the Republican Party in the 10th District of Virginia, a critical district if Republicans are going to have the kind of wave year that they hope to have in November. The 10th District includes Loudoun County, a county that became the centerpiece of conversation nationally in the last year because of the controversies over both the treatment of parents by the school board, the treatment of students by school administrators, and attempts made to cover up a potential sexual assault and other activities that ran afoul of parents' priorities, an outcome that ultimately led to the victory of Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, in November over Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, and potentially turning Virginia from being a blue state back to purple or even a little bit red. Hung Cao is the new nominee. He is a Navy veteran and someone with a very distinct view on these issues as someone with a Vietnamese background. We spoke to him about his intent for running for that 10th District office. We'll have both these interviews coming up next.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mark Esper is the author of A Sacred Oath, Memoirs of a Secretary of Defense During Extraordinary Times. Thank you so much for joining me, Secretary Esper.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be with you.
Let's start with this question. I found a number of your interviews supporting this book to be interesting, but I'd like to talk to you in particular about the state of the U.S. Navy. There seems to be a lot of concern among people who are close to the Navy today that we entered this century with a naval dominance that was really unparalleled since, you know, the British after Trafalgar, whatever, you know, comparison you want to make, and that over the last 20 years, we've seen things really enter a state of decay. You write in your book about the difficulty of navigating that situation. Tell me a little bit about the challenges that are in place for the U.S. Navy today.
Yeah, thanks for drawing this out, Ben. You know, the book is my memoir about my time as Secretary of the Army and specifically Secretary of Defense. So it's, as you kind of suggest, the interviews think that it's a book about Donald Trump, and it's not. It's about a whole host of things, 23 chapters, and one of them is about the Navy. And I wanted to write about it because of all the services, I am most concerned about the United States Navy for kind of the context that you provide there. And if you look at where we are today, we are now the second largest Navy in the world, second to China of all things. China is on the path to continue growing its Navy, and we are treading water at best. It looks like under the Biden administration, they're going to trim more ships. And so I talk about this because in my book, because of my concern about the Navy, but also I want to kind of get into the bureaucracy and the politics of all this, because I think it is an aspect of what's preventing us from doing the right thing when it comes to the Navy. Look, the Navy has its own challenges figuring out, you know, the composition of its force, the number, its own budget items, the shipyards and workforce are problems. I mean, they got a whole host of things that they're trying to juggle, and they just can't seem to move forward. And then on top of this is congressional interests and industry interests and everything else. And the bottom line is, Ben, look, if we're going to take on what I think is the greatest strategic adversary of this century, which is the Chinese Communist Party, then we're going to need a Navy capable of controlling the seas, protecting sea lanes, delivering precision strikes from afar, all those things, if we're going to deter the Chinese, and if deterrence fails, fight and win in the Indo-Pacific. And that's why I put a whole chapter toward this book. And of course, not least because under some criticism on Capitol Hill from congressional Democrats, I decided to not advance the Navy plan for a future Navy, but rather propose my own, working with insiders at the Pentagon and folks in the think tank world. And I thought we came up with a great plan to build a 500 plus ship Navy using a combination of manned and unmanned vessels.
You know, I think one of the things that is frustrating to people today is they understand that we don't have the Navy that we want, but they're uncertain of sort of the different barriers and the different challenges that are in place that really have competing factions trying to advance different visions of what ought to be done. What do you view as the primary challenges to obtaining the Navy that we need in order to balance against that strategic threat in China?
I think first and foremost is probably unified Navy leadership, meaning civilian and uniform, that is able to design a force that will deal with the future. And the designing piece is critical because I personally think we need to move away from this, you know, 11 aircraft carrier paradigm. I'm not sure that they will be as survivable as the brass thinks they will be in a war against the Chinese. I think we need to build far more submarines. It's attack submarines are the distinct qualitative advantage we have versus both the Chinese and the Russians. But you have these tribes within the Navy, right? The surface fleet, then the aviators and the, you know, the carrier guys, the submarine guys, and they all don't want to kind of change. They want their share of the budget. And it is one obstacle to that happening. The second is the shipyards and industry, but that would change if we gave them the right signal when it comes to budget. And then you have congressional interests, right, that are protecting their shipyards, they're protecting their worker bees and all that. But I think it begins with Navy leadership coming together on a bold new vision for what the Navy should look like and do in the future, and then cleaning up their budget to put more of their own budget towards shipbuilding and not towards other things. Mm-hmm.
You talk a little bit about your dispute with Robert O'Brien on this vision. Tell me a little bit about what the sticking points were between the two of you about the direction that ought to be taken.
Well, I don't think we necessarily had a dispute on the vision. I think, you know, Robert believes in the importance of a strong and capable Navy. He was an advocate for it. So he supported the plan that the Pentagon put forward in the end. My concern is, you know, he doesn't have the practical experience with regard to budgets and organizational matters and all those things to understand the trade-offs you have to make. So, I mean, I had particular issues where he wanted to kind of bring out of mothballs some 60s, 70s era ships and kind of refit those. And I thought that was a waste of money. And of course, he kind of wanted to claim ownership over this future force we were constructing. And I just didn't have time for that type of gamesmanship. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, overall, he's a naval advocate. And I think he was in some ways helpful in the terms of the broader messaging about the importance of building a bigger, better Navy.
How much of this, in terms of navigating the politics of the situation, is a built-in level of distrust that you're so identified as being an Army guy?
You know, there is some of that. It's funny that's when people move around the building or get promoted. You know, first General Milley was announced mm-hmm. as next chairman in, I think, December of 2019. And immediately folks were saying, oh, no, another Army guy or a chairman. What will that mean for the service budgets? And then, of course, I was announced in June of 2019. And yeah, those things happen. I think they're all silly because I'm not going to favor one service or another. I'm going to put forward what I think is the best force structure for the United States to meet its national security needs. And I think it's proven by the fact that I proposed a 500 plus ship Navy. I offered to put my own DOD money into the pot, if you will, and increase the Navy budget if the Navy would take similar actions with regard to cleaning up their own budget. So hopefully I proved the critics wrong that I wasn't going to be parochial in that sense. I believe in the importance of a bigger, bolder, different Navy going forward.
The politicization of not just the Navy, but the armed forces in general, but you know, the Navy seems to attract a lot of attention for this, is something that you hear a lot about from Capitol Hill. Republicans, particularly Republican veterans, criticizing what they view as a more politicized force. To what degree is that a real problem? And to what is it, you know, kind of an invention of a shiny object to that distracts us from maybe deeper problems that are happening within our forces?
You know, we have to protect against the armed forces being politicized in any way, shape, or forms. And it ebbs and flows depending on administrations. You know, sometimes they're reacting to, you know, what's coming down from the White House. You know, and sometimes they're kind of anticipating or thinking what the how the political winds are blowing. And look, we got to avoid that. That's crucial. I will tell you, you know, in the summer of 2020, after the you know, the tragic murder of George Floyd, I decided to move ahead and advance with the alongside my civilian and military leadership initiatives to improve diversity and inclusion in the military. Not because we were responding to the political winds, as some were suggesting, but frankly, it became a readiness and morale issue for us that we needed to make sure that we were promoting the best people, not pursuing quotas or anything, but promoting the best people, making sure we were protecting our service members from any type of harm or racism on base or even off the best we can. But in other areas, you see with this administration chasing extremism in the ranks and stuff like that, people are concerned that has gone too far. You know, my view, I came in saying my top priority is warfighting. We have to improve the warfighting readiness of the armed forces. And that was my focus for 18 months. And I think we made a lot of progress to do that, to improve the readiness and capability of the armed forces. And that should be our focus all the time.
To what degree can you really protect against whatever your definition is of extremist or potentially extremist views within people who are so young and so new to the military, many of whom, you know, historically, I would argue, if they had any kind of latent bias or tendency in that direction, that the military actually was something that as an entity could both overcome that and perhaps, track those motivations, whether it be toward violence or toward, you know, activity, in a way that could actually, you know, improve the person in question, lead them to be a better American and indeed someone who can fight for their country.
Yeah. Hey, great question, Ben, and good points. And I will tell you, I dug into this a lot. I had held a lot of listening sessions, nearly two dozen over the summer of 2020 with regard to this. And then prior to that, on the issue of sexual assault and harassment. And look, you're kind of touching on the point. The fact is every year, the U.S. military brings in tens of thousands of young men and women from across the country, 17 to 24 year olds, mostly on the younger end of things. And they come from all walks of life, all experiences, all levels of economic, you know, of wealth or whatever in their background. And they bring different sets of values. Some are very inclusive, some are not. Some learn how to treat each other differently than others. It's a mix. And so what we do is we bring them in and we try and incorporate in them, inculcate them a different set of values, whether it's the Army, Navy, Air Force values, they're all largely the same. And you got them during that basic training period to do that. And I met with all our basic training leaders and talked about this issue. And look, the bottom line is, for the most part, you're trying to undo or change 18 years of training that they received at home or in their community. And we're going to get our share of, there's always a very small number of people who bring some type of extremism in. There's people who treat the other sex the wrong way and they think it's normal. And so I think we do a pretty good job of teaching them a new set of values and behaviors, but some you can't change. And those are the ones you got to weed out. And I had a lot of discussions with folks about that. But again, the bottom line is, I think the military is a great place to bring people in from all walks of life and teach them to respect and embrace one another and to give them a different set of values to live by. And we do a pretty good job generally at that.
One of the things that people are taking out of the experience in Ukraine is lessons regarding the degree to which action ought to be taken now in both increased investment and in perhaps a more focused approach to what weapons and tools are provided to the Taiwanese, given the comparison that could be made that, you know, might have led a lot of people to wish that we had done more along these lines of strengthening the spines of the porcupine in Ukraine. How much ought we be doing to direct the money and the funds that we are using in terms of resources in Taiwan toward a particular strategy or approach? And do you believe that there's clear lessons that ought to be taken from the Ukraine experience and tied to decisions that can be made now regarding Taiwan that we might regret not making in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, there are lessons that obviously should be learned by Taipei and by us to convey to them. I often get asked about what are China's lessons learned, and we can talk about that. But I think the bigger lessons are for Taiwan. And I write about this in the book, by the way. Keep in mind, I wrote the book a year ago, and it took nearly 10 months to get it through DOD. But a year ago, I wrote about the importance of Taiwan preparing itself. I think I discussed there, first of all, they need to increase their defense budget as a share of GDP. They should be allocating money toward their defense, much like Israel does it, a far higher number, because they are in a tough situation being 100 miles or so from China. They need to buy the right equipment. They need to invest in the right type of training. And they need to think about territorial defenses. So they currently conscript so many of their young people a year for a four-month period. They need to extend that at least a year or so. Because look, at the end of the day, and I write about this some, or at least I used to speak about it, we can't get there in time. There's going to be likely a period of days by which they're going to have to defend themselves against the Chinese. And the best way to do that is not with a smaller army, but with mobilization of all 22, 23, 24 million Taiwanese people to fight. You know, they'll have sufficient warning that the Chinese are crossing, which is different from Ukraine, where Russia was just across the border. Mm-hmm. But unlike Ukraine, there's no escaping to Romania or Poland or wherever. You're on the island, and you're either going to be fighting, dying, surrendering, or resisting. And I think the best thing for them to do is to plan to conduct an insurgency and fight the Chinese off. I think, personally, if they do all those things, acquire the right type of equipment, the right type of strategies and doctrine, that's going to be the biggest deterrent that Beijing's going to have to consider if they ever start thinking about now's the time to invade Taiwan. That is the biggest lesson I think the leadership of Taipei can take, and that we and other friends of Taiwan need to convey to them to take seriously and act now.
What's your understanding of what an America First national security policy looks like moving forward?
Well, I don't know how others define it. For me, America First national security policy means that, first of all, we need to have the most ready force capable, modernized for the threats we face, China and Russia in that order. That's going to require sustained investment. We're not seeing that now, frankly, out of the Biden administration. We're seeing flat budgets, and that just is not going to cut it. So there's that. I think, secondly, we need to grow our allies and partners. We need to invest in them, support them, because we're far better off going to war with allies and partners than we are without them. You know, Winston Churchill had that famous phrase that the only thing worse than going to war with allies is going to war without them. They are a force multiplier, and it's not just in terms of capability, but you know, think about basing rights and strategic touch points around the globe and all those things we need logistically to support us. So there are those things. I think we need a strong diplomatic corps to really prevent the conflict in the first place. And then, of course, we have to invest not just in traditional armed forces capabilities, but space, cyber. I give the Trump administration credit. You know, I was able to stand up the Space Force and Space Command. President Trump, really pushed hard for that. I think it was a singular accomplishment of the Trump era. So there are things like that. When I think about America First, it means to me America with allies and partners leading the way with our own robust commitment to our own defense.
There's obviously a major national security issue on the border. And while you touch on this briefly in the book, it received a lot of attention regarding the relation of President Trump's idea of firing missiles at the cartels, either with drones or in other methods. What do you believe is the proper way to deal with the national security side of having what many people now believe to be a nation that's on the cusp of being a failed narco state across our southern border, one that the cartels increasingly control to a really disturbing degree?
Yeah, let me address the anecdote first. That's the story I talk about in the book where the president approached me about firing missiles into Mexico. And as I tried to explain, look, I gave him credit. He was very sincere and genuine about wanting to get rid of drugs in America off our streets. You know, we all have friends or family or whoever that have been affected by it. And he was serious about going after that. And we eventually came up with a plan to put more ships in the Caribbean and do a number of things. I describe it in the book. But the idea of shooting missiles, obviously, I pushed back and said that doesn't make sense. You know, Mr. President, we need to go about other ways to doing that. But I think first and foremost, this comes to another position that I supported and I defended it before Congress. And that is we need to have border security. We need to have a wall to support the Department of Homeland Security on the border. We should absolutely know who is coming across the border, what they're bringing, et cetera. Right now, the situation is out of control. And I supported deploying a small number of troops to the border. It's important to note that the Biden administration continued that. But look, the real answer is an updated set of immigration laws, number one. Number two, beefing up DHS, making sure they have the agents and resources and material they need to get better control of the border. And then foreign policy that really helps deal with the supply side of what's happening there down there in Latin America. The people are coming up across the border. And by the way, it's no longer, I should say, not just folks in Latin America. We constantly learn that people are coming from Ukraine or Iran or wherever into Mexico to make their way across the border. That should concern us. We are not, it's hard to claim that you're a sovereign country and you have security if you can't control your borders. It is really troubling, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Let's go out on this question. Secretary Esper, I feel like the direction that we've seen taken in the last few years, both under President Trump and then other people since the Bush administration, has mostly been toward reorienting American foreign policy and national security around what is conceived as by the American people as our national priorities. In other words, if you have to simplify it, a less utopian view of our capabilities around the world to spread democracy or to dramatically improve situations in the Middle East and the like, and a clearer-eyed perspective on what is achievable with the American military might and through the use of our own resources and spending. As you look at what challenges are coming down the road, do you believe that this is the proper attitude to have, moving away from wars essentially of choice that were designed to dramatically better other nations and more toward use of military force to destroy and to deter?
Well, it's another great question. I think first and foremost, America has to lead in the world. We're really the only remaining superpower and we espouse traditional values. I'm a Reagan Republican, so I think about Ronald Reagan talking about liberty and freedom around the world and self-determination and all those things. So I think we need to lead because if we don't, others simply won't follow and we find ourselves vulnerable to the autocracies of communist China and authoritarian Russia. So I'd say that number one. Number two, while I think we need to be engaged in the world, we have to be careful this traditional, you know, overreach, right? Our ideas and vision and hope sometimes sees to exceed either what's really what we can accomplish or what others want to accomplish for themselves. And look, Afghanistan's a good example. 20 years, we committed billions of dollars, over a trillion to that country. And in some ways, it seemed like we wanted it more than them at the end of the day. And we can kind of talk about that in more detail. I discuss it in the book. But we can't want these situations more than them. We can't want to defend Taiwan more than the Taiwanese want to. And so I'm always looking to other countries to see, are they investing themselves? Are they putting their own dollars and resources and people forward? Or are they relying on us? And we look today at Ukraine and we see the Ukrainian people who are fighting for their country. You know, contrast the last days, the abysmal withdrawal of America from Afghanistan. What did you see? You saw military-aged men jumping on American airplanes trying to leave the country. Contrast that with Ukraine, where you see military-aged men taking up arms and returning to Ukraine to fight for their country. That's what I like to see. Those are the people I like to support. And I think right now they're kind of fighting autocracy on behalf of democracy and us and others. So I think we need to have a more realistic approach to that. I like to see our foreign policy less militarized. In other words, we should be leading with our diplomats and our foreign assistants and things like that, our soft power, and then rely on the hard power when you really need it. So those are kind of my general principles. But I think we have to understand it's important that America lead in the world, but we can't be the world's policeman and we can't solve everybody's problems. Mm-hmm. That's true.
Thank you, Secretary Esper, for being so generous with your time. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you, Ben. Appreciate it.
And now Hung Cao, the new nominee for Virginia 10th District from the Republican Party. I'm joined now by Hung Cao, who is the winner of the primary to represent the Republican Party within the 10th District of Virginia, a district that has attracted enormous national attention over the past year or more. Thanks so much for taking the time to join me, and congratulations on your win.
Thank you, Ben.
I would like to start by just sort of asking you about your own history. Loudoun County is obviously a place that has seen an influx of new populations over the last several decades, and people moving into the area of what was once kind of a farming community, a very rural area, and one that certainly didn't seem like the kind of thing to attract national attention, as we'll get into in a bit. How did you end up in Loudoun, and how did you find your way there? What brought you to this county?
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So Loudoun County, I remember when my sister first got married, she moved out to a place called Sterling, and it was all dirt roads. 777 was literally just a dirt road. And now it's a bustling metropolitan area almost. I came here. Let me just go back all the way up. I came to the United States as a refugee from Vietnam. And, we spent many years in Africa because my dad could not find any work over here. So we had to move to Africa. And I grew up over there, came back. We came back here in 1982 when I was about 12 years old, and I went to school here, and I had to learn English all over again because I spoke French, only French in Africa. So I learned English, and then I went to Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology, the largest, the number one high school in the nation. Well, it was until they changed the entrance criteria. Then I went to the United States Naval Academy. Yeah. I went to Naval Academy, and then I served our military for the next 25 years. And then, so when my parents started moving out here. My parents were in Sterling first, and then Ashby Ponds in Ashburn. And so I wanted my final tour to be near them because my father just passed away three months ago.
What made you feel like the need to get involved in the political scene out there, given that it's been in recent memory a lot more fractious than it had been before?
Thank you for that question. I mean, it's just really, you're right. It has been more fractious. And I think it's fractious because there's a small minority group that is trying to split us all apart, and divide us, blacks versus whites, men versus women, minorities against, you name it, and straight versus gay. It's just, people try to split us apart, but remember our country's motto is E Pluribus Unum, out of many one. And instead of uniting us, they're just trying to split us apart because it's easier to really suppress us if you think about it. What caused me to join the fight here is just that, when I left Kabul in January of 2021, my last tour over there, it was pretty stable. And watching Kabul fall 6 months later, it just broke my heart. Watching mothers hand babies to Marines, just reminded me what happened in 1975 when Vietnam fell, and so it just really kind of pushed me to join the fight here because I could not see this great American dream break apart because one person is basically driving it to the ground, which is Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm. There is, within the conversation around the country, a greater awareness now than I ever thought would exist when I was growing up there of Loudoun County because of the fights that have happened there between parents and the school board authorities and the administrators of the schools there. It became essentially a national word that symbolized the fight between parents and both a woke school agenda, an out-of-touch school agenda, and one that wasn't actually interested in educating students so much as indoctrinating them. Education is obviously an area where the states have more authority than the federal government in terms of their ability to determine the way things that stand, and that's as it ought to be. But this also seems to be something where the states are taking their marching orders from the federal government, from the Department of Education and the like. If you get to Congress, what will you try to do to have oversight over what the Department of Education is doing and to push back against an agenda that seems to be, from the left's perspective, at the top of the list of priorities for what they want to do with public schools?
Yes, you're right. The education should stay at the state and local level. And my job in Congress is to make sure that it stays in that area. I mean, we have an amazing governor now, Glenn Youngkin. We have a great Secretary of Education that can handle all these issues. And so my job is to make sure the federal government stays out of the way so that the money doesn't go directly from the Department of Education straight to the schools, which in some cases it does, because they'll mandate certain educational programs, you know, like even up to critical race theory. And so, I mean, that's indoctrinating our kids, and it's really a leftist, Marxist, you know, communist, socialist, whatever you call it, or equity agenda. And that's everything that I and a lot of immigrants in the 10th district ran away from. There's 45% of us that are immigrants in this the district, and this is not what we came to the United States for. They're turning this country into what we ran away from.
You know, I know that it was a very competitive situation out there in terms of who would run in the 10th. Why do you believe that you won that competition to represent Republicans? And what was the separating factor for you in winning over those voters?
So we saw in 2021, the Virginians, you know, Virginians spoke up in large masses saying, we want an outsider. We're a political outsider. We don't want any more establishment people. And that's why they brought in Glenn Youngkin. And then they wanted also people that look like them and think like them, like Jason Miaris and Lieutenant Governor Winsome Sears, right? And again, I said that 45% of the 10th district is minorities. Of the 25% are immigrants. And so they're looking for somebody that looks and thinks like them that says, hey, you know what? It's okay to think this way. It's okay to want things like freedom and equality, not equity, equality, and want, you know, want the boys to be separated from the girls in from bathrooms, right? And to stop destroying what it means to be a woman. These are things that we came to this country for, and this is what we believe in. And even the red-blooded Americans, like my father-in-law and my mother-in-law, you know, this is not what they worked hard for years. And so I think I speak for all Americans when I say enough of government overreach, enough of getting into our business, into our homes, into our schools, into our churches. You know, stay out of it. Let Americans be Americans.
Most of the focus coming out of the controversy regarding critical race theory and the like has focused on black and white. What's been left out of a lot of the conversation is the way that this structure treats other students who don't fall into those categories. Tell me in particular what the ramifications have been for students of Asian immigrants or Asian families, either in the 10th district or in the Commonwealth of Virginia, for the approach that has been used, which has taken away so many of the different programs that formerly were ones where they could find success.
So I think you're mentioning Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology. I was the first class to graduate there, and it was an amazing school where half of my class, you can address them as doctor, right? I mean, that's how brilliant some of these kids are. And, you know, we went on to serve this country, our government. I mean, half, like I said, half of them are physicians. One of them, Raj Garg, you know, Indian American that went there, was my father's cardiologist for years. And so, you know, to take away the opportunity, like schools like Thomas Jefferson, where by changing the entrance criteria from a meritocracy to really a hybrid system where they're looking at demographics to bring in, it destroys and dilutes the school itself. And it brought down the number of Asians from 73% to 53%. And really, that's, if you think about it, it's not fair, right? It's not fair for these kids who worked so hard. My parents drove education into us because they, you know, again, as a refugee, they said, look, they can take away your money, they can take away your position in life, but they can never take away the knowledge that's in your head. And that's why education is so important to us. And so we strive for it. And now that's being taken away from us as well, the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your own foreign policy views. President Biden is obviously traveling in Asia this week and, you know, has made a bunch of different comments, one of which that attracted attention, of course, was his dedication that the United States would defend Taiwan against a Chinese incursion or any attempt to seize it, something that a lot of people think is potentially more likely now than it has been historically for a number of reasons. In terms of the position that you have, how do you view Taiwan in the context of, you know, an America first foreign policy, one that, you know, continues America's role in leading the world, and as an ally, given that, you know, the Chinese may very well move on it in the coming years, and our Navy is not really up to potentially the challenge of that situation, that they're going to have to do a lot to defend themselves, and we'll probably have to do a lot to build ourselves up in order to take something like that on. What's your perspective on it?
Oh, gosh, this is a huge plethora of issues going on. So under the Obama administration, they've basically destroyed the military so that really we couldn't even, you know, invade, Alaska if we wanted to, because there's not enough munitions. So when I came into the Pentagon in 2016, President Trump, you know, we were counting every missile, every bomb. But then President Trump came in 2017 and really started fixing the military. We had ships that couldn't get underway, aircrafts that couldn't fly, and submarines that can't dive, which is a problem. And that's going to be a problem for us in the South China Sea as well. What you're talking about is also the Taiwan Relations Act, which is not really as close to a treaty as we can get, but it's really under the Reagan doctrine, where it's about peace to strength. It says that we will seek every means to come to a peaceful resolution with China on behalf of Taiwan. We will give them weapons. We will give them training, and we have been doing that. But right now, the problem is that the White House keeps walking back every time the president says something. They're like, well, he didn't really mean this. And so it just makes us look weak. You know, who's really in charge of the White House? I mean, the president's right. I have to give him credit. Yes, we need to step in, because Taiwan is a strategic location, not just for where it is in the world, but also, you know, 50% of the world's chips are made there. But of those 50%, 92% of all the high-end chips in the world, which includes our weapon systems, are made in Taiwan. If China takes that over, that becomes a strategic problem for us, for weapon systems, for new machinery. And again, under Obama, they've drove out all the foundries in the United States, so we don't even make our own chips anymore. And so this becomes a huge strategic problem. And the weapons that we, you know, under the Taiwan Relations Act, we were in the process of giving them weapons, but then now we've diverted it all to Ukraine. And that's the stuff that they need, Stinger weapons systems, really the newest and latest types, right? Not just the old things that were built in the 70s with infrared sensors. We need things that can see through the clouds to defend the Taiwan Straits, you know, against the Chinese aggression. And, you know, anybody who knows government contracting knows that if you say today I'm going to buy some weapons, that means it doesn't go into the budget until 2024, if Congress passes a budget. And then with that, once the money's allocated, it takes 2 years for it to roll off the industry line. So now we're looking at 2026 before a weapon is delivered to Taiwan to help protect them.
I want to go out on this. You, I'm told, have a challenge coin that references your name. Friend told me this last night.
Oh, goodness.
What's this all about?
Well, so, you know, it's a play on words. And I'm sure some of the people, oh, my gosh, he's so misogynistic. But it says my congressman is hung. And hung in Vietnamese means brave. And so that's what it is. It's a play on words. It's nothing bad or anything like that. It just means, you know, you want your congressman to be brave. You want leaders in Congress that will step up to the plate. And it's just a play. And then there's a hung cow. There's actually a cow hanging from a noose. My men had made this. My men made this stencil in Iraq, and they spray painted all over the T-walls in Iraq. And so we were driving by one time. We're on a mission, and on the way back, I saw these hanging cows all over the place. I'm like, what the heck is that? And they made a stencil of me, and they spray painted all over this countryside in Iraq.
Look, I'll tell you this. Congress could use a sense of humor around these times, so I'm glad that you have one, and congratulations on your victory. You'll obviously be one of the most watched congressional races this year, and certainly one that could tell us a lot about the direction the country is headed. Thank you so much, Hung Cao, for taking the time to join me today.
No, thank you so much, Ben. You have a great day.
So I want to talk to you a little bit about something that got a bit of attention this past week. On Friday, I received the good news that the Third Circuit Court of Appeals had ruled unanimously in my favor after a multi-year long back and forth, a lawsuit against me that was brought by the National Labor Relations Board at the behest of a couple of online Twitter trolls, leftists who had attempted to use a tweet that I had made to weaponize it against me and my company. At the time, as publisher of The Federalist, I had been observing a walkout that was happening from Vox Media, the leftist media outlet, with a bunch of lefty media folks, white-collar, well-educated people, LARPing as blue-collar, hard-hat-wearing workers and attempting to unionize. I thought the scene was fairly silly looking, and my commentary on it was that, and this is what I tweeted out, FYI, at Federalist, first one of you tries to unionize, I'm going to send you back to the salt mines. Now, I thought this was an obvious joke. My staff thought it was an obvious joke. Of course, I don't own any salt mines, though I think I should have looked into investing in them before I made this joke. But these leftists tried to turn this into literally a federal case, one that you as American taxpayers paid for the coming 3 years. They sued me in a way that allowed the National Labor Relations Board to threaten to invade our privacy, to try to subpoena all of our worker communications, any emails back and forth between employees, including emails that would include privileged information, conversations about sourcing and the like, all the behind the scenes work of the Federalist. And they used my tweet to try to do that. I pushed back against them. I fought them. And thankfully, I had an ally in the New Civil Liberties Alliance, a small group of nonprofit attorneys who are bent on fighting the administrative state and the overreach of bureaucracy. The NCLA said, you know, we think you have a really good case, both on First Amendment grounds and on the fact that the NLRB really hasn't tested this type of ability that they have to essentially be weaponized at the behest of any random American, not someone who's ever met you, worked for you, worked with you in any capacity as a contractor or an employee or the like, to just take you and turn your tweet into a federal case. At the end of the day, I agreed. And we pursued this understanding that with clear eyes that we were going to lose in the early going, lose because the administrative law judge, which is the person you have to go in front of, is essentially just a rotating bureaucrat. One day they're representing the state trying to crush somebody. The next day they're adjudicating someone else trying to do the crushing. And so from my perspective, this was something where I had this unique ability, this unique situation where I could last this out. I could go through the process of the Kafkaesque experience of American bureaucracy and bureaucratic governance in order to get to a real court. In this case, we ended up at the Third Circuit, which is a real court, in front of judges who pretty clearly sent the message that even during oral arguments, that they were not really buying what the NLRB was selling. At the end, they ultimately found completely against the NLRB's argument and dismissed this idea that any reasonable person could consider my comment anything other than a joke. And in addition, they raised questions in both the unanimous opinion and then even more so in the concurrence from one of the justices, that this is an area that needs to be resolved, that the Supreme Court or the Congress needs to weigh in on this idea that anyone can just go around and start a federal case against someone if they don't like what they are saying. Look, we live in an era where, according to some polls, the majority of people who self-identify as liberal believe that if you voted for or gave money to Republican candidates, that you ought to be able to be fired for doing that. this is a scary time for a lot of people because the targeting that's happening isn't just happening to Supreme Court justices. It's happening to a lot of other people too. And one of the things that I think we need to understand is that this targeting is only going to continue. People are going to go after you if you say things that they don't like, and they are going to use every ability, every tool at their disposal in order to do so. And that's something that the left, I think, is even more likely to do once they lose the reins of power, as we expect them to this November within the Congress. They've had people in leadership there for a very long time. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and the like, they've been around for 30 years. And when they lose that control, the reaction of the left, I believe, will be increased acts of desperation, attempts to shut down people whose views they dislike, targeting and going after organizations who say things that they don't like, and doing so in an increasingly aggressive way, using all the power they have and that they've been equipped by via the bureaucracy and the administrative state. We have to have more people who are willing to stand up and take on entities like this. And we have to have more organizations like the NCLA, like the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and others that will stand up for people when they are experiencing the slings and arrows of the enemy, and push back against it. Make the argument that this is about law and order, not public and punishing the people just because they have ideological disagreements. That's what America is about. I'm glad that the court ruled in my favor. I hope and I encourage the National Labor Relations Board to go forward with this case, to appeal to the Supreme Court, because if they do, they will get shut down to an even greater degree. And hopefully we can have some resolution to the over encroachment of people's lives that we have seen under a board that ought, from my perspective, never be given the kind of power that it now has bequeathed unto itself. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more to dive back into the fray.
The power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.